Hi, this is Pete Fornitzow with the Crawdaddy Rock Review, produced in association with the editors of Crawdaddy Magazine and presented by Discwasher, makers of ultimate record care equipment. Stay tuned for a fast hour of music, news, and interviews. On this edition of the Crawdaddy Rock Review, we'll feature Mary Kay Place, sometimes better known as Loretta Haggers on Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman, and the Fernwood Forever television programs. We'll learn just how Mary Kay became Loretta, as well as talk about her new album. Also, we'll be speaking with Dickie Betts, ex-Allman Brother and now leader of Great Southern. We'll also have our regular nonsense facts, comedy classics, and music reviews. We'll start with a listen to Randy Newman as the Crawdaddy Rock Review continues. And now the Crawdaddy Rock Review gives you a capsule summary of thoughts and reactions to a brand new album release. Randy Newman has been creating lovable deviants again, and they've gathered together as Little Criminals, the title of his new album.
What you won't come back here for? Thought you with your uptown friends. Don't need none of your junkie things. Gonna screw us up again. Get your blackjack off my table. Get your coat out of my rack. We don't need you around here, sugar. Chuck, I want you off my back. We're almost made it. Almost made it.
Newman's particular brand of warped comedy is in full display here, and as sensitive, mean, bittersweet, snide, and sadistic as ever.
Sitting with a fat man, trying to get along, talking about the horses, the women that we've known, spitting on the sidewalk. Went into the sun, greeting all the people, smiling at everyone.
The same man who explained, "Mama told me not to come," and exhorted us to drop the big one, continues to startle and amuse with indelible characters and images. Newman's Little Criminals includes a look at short people, his succinct expression of the mindset of the 70s. Randy Newman is surely more than a joker spinning simple tales. The editors of Crawdaddy Magazine place him in the same ironic tradition of Mark Twain, Robert Benchley, and the Marx Brothers. You just never know when he's being serious.
The world of science is my game. Albert Einstein is my name. I was born in Germany, and I'm happy to be here in the land of brave and the free.
Little Criminals and its ambiguous themes is a strong dose of Newman at his best, creating brilliant short stories with a keen eye and a sensitive heart.
Phonograph records are invaluable items for the musical enjoyment and the excellent sound they provide. The Discwasher record cleaning system helps you preserve both the value and the sound of your record library. The beautiful walnut handle is the first thing you'll notice, but it's Discwasher's patented directional microfibers and unique D3 fluid that safely frees your records of dust and fingerprints. D3 fluid has unequaled cleaning activity, but does not harm the important vinyl additives used by record manufacturers to prevent deterioration. Only Discwasher uses a fluid designed for both thorough cleaning and safety to vinyl. You'll find cheaper copies, but there's only one Discwasher at fine audio centers and record stores everywhere. Or write to Discwasher Incorporated, 1407 North Providence Road, Columbia, Missouri, 65201.
This is Pete Fornital back on the Crawdaddy Rock Review, brought to you by Discwasher. And my guest this segment is Mary Kay Place, currently the star of Forever Fernwood, not Fernwood Forever, a recording artist for Columbia Records, and most recently an Emmy winner. How much of Mary Kay Place is Loretta Haggar's and vice versa?
Oh, hon, there's just a whole bunch of Loretta in me. I think I'm much smarter than Loretta. I think Loretta's probably much nicer every single moment of her life than I am. I'm nice. I think I'm a nice person, but I think Loretta is just extremely good and pure, you know, and kind. There's a lot of Loretta in me. I love homilies and cliches, and particularly old cliches. I think they're great phrases. My whole life I said things that my grandmother and mother, who's a queen of cliches, and my mother has everything, tighter than Dick's hat band, hotter than deep hole stove. I mean, they come out of her mouth 90 to nothing. That's another one. And I've much preferred those phrases to things like far out and heavy.
Gotcha.
So I've always said those, even when people looked at me like I was foolish. So it was fun to do Loretta because I was real, and I had done her in sketches in junior high school and high school and forever. So, and Loretta is a composite attitude-wise and just voice tone and all that of a lot of my family. Who are all from Texas. So.
Do they recognize themselves on the screen?
They laugh. They go, "You're doing cousin, or you're doing your granddaddy there," and yeah.
How much freedom did you have in molding the character?
All the freedom, a great deal. The character was extremely well written. There's a man, Daniel Gregory Brown, who was one of the early writers the first season, who was a country fanatic, who really knew a lot about the country music scene and who just wrote. I mean, I read the character the first time and was stunned and amazed that this person had locked in. Because I used to write that character a great deal. The first script I ever wrote was a spec script for Mary Tyler Moore, and it had a version of Loretta. She was a college graduate. She was coming from a little different direction, not as nice as Loretta, but still had a lot of the characteristics. And I said, "Wait a minute, this guy knows this character that I've done my whole life." But any actress could have interpreted that good writing in any way. I mean, there's millions of different choices you make with the same written material. So obviously the choices that I made were choices from my family and people that I had known.
How did Mary Kay Place get to be Loretta Haggar's?
I was writing a pilot for Norman Lear at the time. Which eventually, after many rewrites and other people becoming involved, became One Day at a Time. But it was the original concept of that. And they were casting Mary Hartman. And I had done a little acting here and there, but mainly was, you know, writing.
I would like to point out to our listeners that though it might have been a little acting to you, there were memorable bits. There was the All in the Family episode that you sang at Archie's door. What was the song?
It was one of my more profound songs. It was called, that I've written, "If Communism Comes Knocking at Your Door, Don't Answer It."
That's a memorable scene, and it continues to rerun on afternoon television.
I've heard tell of that, yes. I haven't seen that in a while.
And I recall that it looked for a time, as an avid viewer of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, that your status as the next door neighbor with Penny Marshall as a roommate.
Oh, right, yeah. Now, actually, I did that acting job after I had done the pilot of Mary Hartman, although it hadn't gotten on the air yet.
Oh, I see. So there was a gap. People weren't ready for the...
I really hadn't started. Yeah, in fact, we thought at that point that Mary Hartman, although secretly in my heart I knew that by hook or crook that thing was going to get on because it was too bizarre not to. But at that time they had, for the most part, given up on it. We did a pilot and took a year to get it on the air. So I was writing this pilot, and because I had done these little acting things and they knew... I mean, to me, writing is extremely difficult. It is the hardest of all of the processes in getting a film together, whatever, I think, for me anyway. And I, acting was a fun break. So they said, Mary Kay, which offhandedly, we're looking for the part of Louise Lasser's sister, Kathy, and you have the similar coloring and whatever, that why don't you take these home and read them and see what you think? You see if you're interested. So I said, are you kidding? I'd love to do something like that. Because I thought, you know, with all these different characters, soap, you could work a couple of days a week acting. I could work on my movie. And I thought, a great schedule, you know. So I take these scripts home, and I see the character of Loretta, and I said, forget Kathy, I'm Loretta. What are you, crazy? But they had already cast the part of Loretta.
Really?
A taller, older woman with dark hair. And they, I mean, I just didn't even remotely fit the image that they had in mind of what Loretta Haggers was like, because they'd already cast Graham Jarvis as Charlie.
Uh-huh.
So I just can't even be in this show if I can't be Loretta. I mean, Loretta is me. I've been doing this my whole life, writing country songs and whatever. So when I went to audition for Norman for the part of Kathy, I kind of ran through the lines real quickly, and I had mentioned to someone, and all weekend I wrote music to lyrics of a song that they had in the script, It Feels So Good When You Feel Me. So I wrote music to that, and I had this entire mammoth speech memorized in the character of Loretta. And so offhandedly said, well, why don't you do some of that Oklahoma stuff? And I just proceeded to do this entire scene, you know, when real obvious that I had not been working all weekend on this character. So eventually I ended up playing Loretta.
That's wonderful. It is. Did you expect the show to have the impact that it did on your life?
On my life? No. But I have to be brutally honest. I did think the show would have an impact from the first time I read those first five scripts. I said, this is a bizarre, very unusual thing here. And I knew that it was going to have an impact of some kind.
One of the opportunities that has come along is doing films. You've made two movies.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an area you'd like to pursue as well?
Yes, very much. In fact, I just signed with ABC Television to do some movies of the week.
How about your music? How important is music to you, Mary Kay?
Real important. I really like it a lot.
Going back a long way?
I've always loved it. I mean, there are people who can be found in the United States of America who will remember me in elementary school singing in the assemblies. My grandmother took me to a March of Dimes telethon when I was about six, and I had on a pair of rolled-up blue jeans, and I sang Blue Suede Shoes and You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog and Don't Be Cruel.
Whoa.
So actually, I had to have been older than six to have sung those particular tunes. But I've always enjoyed singing a lot. I did not pursue it when I came to L.A. because it's a very tough business to get into, and there were so many things that I was interested in, and I felt that that was one that I could shelve till a more appropriate time. And oddly enough, that was one of the reasons I was excited about Loretta, because I said, if there's ever a chance to really get to do something musically, it will be, you know, with Loretta.
Right.
So, musically, I made very sure that the first album would be Loretta Haggers and the second album would be Mary Kay Place, because there are certain things that I wanted to do and write as a songwriter that wouldn't fall in the genre of Loretta Haggers. And I just, I was more interested in writing anything I felt like writing than locking. I mean, Loretta writes lyrics like had no hair on his head but a lot above his lip, and chunky tuna lyrics, you know, and I think that I'm not above writing a chunky tuna lyric as Mary Kay Place, but I also have other kinds of styles of writing that I like.
It's been a while since the first album now. How do you feel about it with some hindsight?
Well, I had hives during the recording of that album, so I was very intimidated because I was working with the Hot Band, who is Emmylou Harris's band, which is composed of very terrific, well-known musicians, Glenn D. Hardin and Emery Gordy, and just incredible Albert Lee musicians. And also Emmylou was right there playing acoustic guitar and singing backup, and Brian Ahern, the producer. And I was very frightened of the whole thing. I mean, it's one thing to sing your guts out in your living room or bathtub, and it's another thing to have all the musicians there and just get to do it right, you know. And I was real excited but real scared at the same time. And I think there are sections of the album that reflect that I was nervous about making it, and it was a first effort. But that's the exciting thing about music and about singing, or any of the arts. The more you do it, the better you get. Mm-hmm. And so that I studied voice this past year, and the second album, I think the vocal quality is much better. Okay. So I'm real encouraged by this. I was very encouraged by the second album because we had a great time doing it. I was relaxed. By this time, I knew the Hot Band.
Was it basically the same creative team?
James Burton was added as lead guitar player, who just did some fabulous stuff. I mean, he just knocked me out. And it was Brian Ahern again and Emmylou. But by this time, all the Hot Band members had played in the Capri Lounge with me on Mary Hartman's. It was great fun doing this album.
What is the album called this time?
It's called Aimin' to Please, and we got that little quote because it's done like a 40s, the Vargas, those illustration.
Oh, yes, sure.
From the 40s, it's that style, and so they always had these little funny quotes underneath them. So we
And yours is Aimin' to Please. You got an opportunity to do a duet with Willie Nelson.
Right, and that was great fun because I really like Willie a lot. And we sang an old George Jones, Tammy Wynette song called Something to Brag About that has classic lyrics in it.
Great, let's take a break right here and listen.
I got a real important job in a large office building, riding people in an elevator. I drive a 57 Chevrolet with a busted taillight, burned out valves and a leaky radiator. And I wear a $20 suit that I bought from JCPenney's. Back in 1962, but I've got something to brag about, something to brag about, something to brag about in you.
Well, I'm a short order cook in an all-night cafe down on 18th Avenue and 12th Street. I wear a swinging mini dress that I made for myself from Mama's.
Tell your girlfriend about my sweet, sweet loving, and that's one figure that money can't buy.
So let's get married in the not too distant future. We'll rent a little flat on 29th Street. You know we'll hang our washing from the clothesline on the window. We'll feast on cornbread, butter, beans, and lunch meat. We all have a thermostat, a big log. Something to brag about in you.
That's Something to Brag About, a duet by Willie Nelson and Mary Kay Place from Mary Kay's new album, Aimin' to Please. Are you going to get out on the road? Are we going to see you perform live this go-around?
Yes, for the first time. This is the first time I've had a break in my life to be able to put all this together. Probably toward the end of January and February I'll be out. And I hope to go out with a Hot Band.
Is the success that you've had all that you perhaps at one point in your life imagined it to be?
I think it's wonderfully exciting. I think creatively it is a wonderful way to spend your life, but I think that people who usually have dreams about success have no clue as to what it's really like. I mean, you don't wake up every morning going, oh, I'm so happy. more you wake up every morning going, okay, now I've got to write a killer song today, or I've got to write a fabulous scene that everyone's going to relate to and say, my gosh, I've been there. I know that. I'm so touched by this. And the challenge of that is a very difficult thing to face each day.
Mary Kay Place, four things. Let's see if I remember them. Congratulations on your Emmy. Continued success on Fernwood Forever. Good luck with the new album.
Thank you.
And thanks for taking some time for the Crawdaddy Rock
Review.
It's been
great talking to you.
We'll see you again.
I appreciate it.
This is Pete Fornital back on the Crawdaddy Rock Review, and it's time now for Crawdaddy's Comedy Classics. The 1930s will long be remembered as the golden age of radio, and one outstanding reason was the incredibly popular side-splitting feud between a mischievous wisecracking dummy and a snarling master of insults. Week after week at 8 p.m. Sunday evening, it was time to catch the latest verbal splinters in one of the most inspired comic duels ever. W.C. Fields with Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy.
Is it true, Mr. Fields, that when you stood on the corner of Hollywood and Vine, 43 cars waited for your nose to change to green?
No way, you woodpecker's lunch.
Having triumphed in vaudeville, legitimate theater, and movies, radio was the final medium that Claude William Duncan Field would conquer, and conquer he did. The classic Fields-McCarthy feud showed both teams at their best. Charlie's impish impertinence was the perfect foil for Fields' snide mutterings and manifestos. Today, 31 years after his death, the influence of W.C. Fields can still be heard in comic routines and in our everyday kidding around. Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy are enjoying a revival in nightclubs and TV appearances, but never again will the airwaves crackle with the electric banter of the blockhead and the tomato nose.
If it isn't up to see. The original half-man, half-nose with.
Well, Charlie McCarthy, the woodpecker's pin-up boy.
Well, as long as you're here, Bill, you can talk to me while Charlie's getting his hair cut.
You know, Edgar, it's touching to see your affection for the little nipper. It strikes a tender chord in my heart.
Oh, thank you, Bill. You know, I thought you didn't like children.
Oh, not at all, Edgar. I love children. I can remember when, with my own little unsteady legs, I toddled from room to room.
When was that, last night?
Quiet, Wormwood, or I'll whittle you down to a coat hanger.
Yeah.
Tell me, Charles, is it true your father was a gate-legged table?
If it is, your father was under it, or...
Why, you stunted spruce. I'll throw a Japanese beetle on you.
Why, you barfly, you. I'll stick a wick in your mouth and use you for an alcohol lamp without it.
Is Mr. Fields, are you eating a tomato or is that your nose?
That's a comical. Keep quiet. Stop scratching yourself. You'll get sawdust all over the floor.
Now, stop it. Remember, Mr. Fields is not a well man, are you, Bill?
No, that's right, Edgar.
Yeah.
I've been a fragile thing of beauty ever since I was born.
Yeah.
Why, you weren't born. You were squeezed out of a bar rag.
That's it for today's Crawdaddy Comedy Classic. This is Pete Fornital.
And now the Crawdaddy Rock Review gives you a capsule summary of thoughts and reactions to a brand new album release. If you don't already trust Joan Armatrading as an exceptionally forthright huntress and performer, her new album title may sound as something strange and hollow, but Armatrading has earned the right to be blunt. Despite three previous well-received albums, this London-based West Indian is still waiting to break big. She remains a determined, warm-hearted composer, and Show Some Emotion may very well prove that the fourth time's the charm. While the title cut is mostly lickety-split jazz changes, it is on the stripped-down Won't You Come On Home that Armatrading exhibits her full virtues.
Every light is on, but all the rooms are empty except one. Oh, baby, don't stay too late. You know I hate to be alone, and I'm alone. Baby, won't you come on home? There's a map standing on the corner, and he keeps on looking at my window. Oh, babe, won't you come on home? Home.
The exuberantly tight Mama Mercy shows Joan's liking for the kind of vocal phrasing that springs right out of a vigorous guitar riff.
I was catching up with my baby when I saw it coming down the road. I thought, Mercy, Mama, don't let it get me. I got a happy life at home, but it's sure and sure as you pass me, of course I had to look. And as I turned my head, I knew right then I was gonna have to do it again. And I was singing, Mercy, Mercy, Mama, don't you try to get me. I don't know my life, but I never said it's gonna happen.
There aren't many who can exalt heart sickness as Armatrading does. For her, it seems a good pain that occurs on the borderline of love and pride.
I wanna beat up your advances, but know that you are winning. Water for your thirst, your fuel to burn. Let me be your night potion, your wine.
The editors of Crawdaddy Magazine salute her musicianship and spirit that has kept Joan patrolling that pain in as compelling a way as she did 5 years ago on her first release. Show Some Emotion proves that Joan Armatrading definitely has it. The Crawdaddy Rock Review now delivers a brief listen to bits of unsettling news and nonsense facts from around the national neighborhood.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has given the go-ahead for Western pear farmers to BAM their produce. BAAM was previously banned as a suspected cancer-causing pesticide. The spray is used to prevent fruit disfiguration by a harmless plant louse. The EPA reversed itself when farmers complained that consumers would rather buy possibly carcinogenic pretty pears than the scarred but healthy variety. A blinding snowstorm must be building somewhere, possibly everywhere, as the U.S. government reports that at least 1 ton of pure cocaine is smuggled into the country every week. Marymount College, Ohio, can expect a rush at registration time for its new class called The Art of Doing Nothing. Officials say the course is designed to help people relax, with a guarantee the class is better than going to a bar and cheaper than a psychiatrist. Governmental word games have been honored by the New York Times, which awarded its grand prize for euphemism to the CIA. The intelligence agency earned this dubious distinction by its reference to an assassination unit as a health alteration committee. Dr. Robert Stolar, a UCLA psychoanalyst, has contradicted Freud's infamous envy theory by maintaining his studies show that in fact all little boys start life by wishing they were little girls. Dr. Stolar asserts it's a natural reaction for babies since the mother, not the father, is the parent with whom they identify first. That's it for today's Nonsense News. This is Pete Fornital.
To a lot of music lovers, static electricity is an enemy. Static charges in a record cause loud pops that can ruin the enjoyment of your music system. You can stop that noise with a Zerostat from Discwasher. Zerostat is the ultimate anti-static device. It looks like a pistol, and with the squeeze and release of the trigger, the Zerostat emits millions of positive and negative ions to neutralize any surface, be it a phonograph record, plastic dust cover, or negatives in a dark room. So you see, the Zerostat has many uses in fighting static and the dust it always attracts. Zerostat is safe, has no cartridge to replace, and nothing to plug into the wall. Look for Zerostat at Discwasher dealers, or write to Discwasher Incorporated, 1407 North Providence Road, Columbia, Missouri, 65201. That's Discwasher Incorporated, Columbia, Missouri, 65201.
Hi, this is Pete Fornital with the Crawdaddy Rock Review, presented by Discwasher. My guest today, Dickie Betts. It must be gratifying for you at this point to realize that what was once considered a very limited form of music, for lack of a better term, Southern rock and roll, whatever, has now penetrated, you know, every corner of the States and almost every corner of the world. How do you feel about that?
I don't know, maybe it's time to stop calling it Southern rock and roll.
Okay.
Because of that, you know. It's pretty widespread now. It's becoming hard anymore to even tell if a group is from the South or, you know, or what, because what we call Southern rock has influenced a lot of groups, you know, all over the country.
You must have felt that there was a turning point somewhere along the line, whether it was measured in terms of record sales or more people than you had ever seen before showing up at concerts or playing at places where you had never set foot before.
Well, definitely with the Allman Brothers, the big turning point for us was the airplay we got on Ramblin' Man single.
Sure,
but it turned everything right upside down.
Even before that, the Allman Brothers could claim the distinction of being one of the only groups that sold phenomenal numbers of albums without hit singles.
You know, back 5-6 years ago, the FM radio would support a group that wasn't selling singles too, a lot more than they will today. FM radio has become much more competitive with AM radio. And so back then, you didn't have to have a hit single to have your album played. It was sort of a real underground, nice thing, you know, happening. Mm-hmm. And that supported us a lot, the FM radio, because they would play our album, and we, like, would tour continuously, and we reached a lot of people.
This is a new beginning for you, in a sense. That seems odd to say to someone who's been out there in the public eye as long as you have. How did you feel about stepping out, fronting your own band, Great Southern, and in a sense starting all over again after those phenomenally successful years?
I didn't really have any second thoughts about it musically, you know, or what I would do performance-wise. I never took time to think about that. You know, I knew that I'd been performing for 15 years, and there was no need to question that. It would just come. But the thing that I've noticed that I really wasn't expecting is the responsibility, you know, that comes with it. You know, you really have to kind of take it all on your shoulders if a show doesn't sell the way you hoped it would, or if the people that come to see you weren't, you know, if they didn't really show a lot of excitement, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
or if you have trouble, personal trouble in the band, even in the road crew, you know, and the whole thing, it kind of, that whole responsibility kind of drops on your shoulders, you know, and I wasn't expecting that. That's the part that's really been rough.
Do you feel that your music is basically a continuation of what you were doing with the Allman Brothers?
Yes. I would say that I don't really have too much control over it being otherwise. You know.
From your perspective, Dickie, the Allman Brothers splintered into what looks like three very separate and very distinct mm-hmm. entities.
Yeah, that's what I see a lot with Chuck and myself and Greg.
How do you feel about what Sea Level is doing and Greg's new band?
Well, I'm really proud of Chuck. I haven't really heard too much of Greg yet.
Uh-huh.
I've heard some cuts from his album, which I think are really good. He's singing better than ever.
The Allman Brothers was such a big part of your life for so long. Why did it come to an end?
I think just for the good of everybody involved. You know, 8 years is really an awful long time to try and keep something, you know, vibrant and fresh and alive, you know. I think sort of relating back to the people around you having a lot to do with how you write or compose or perform, I think maybe it's healthy to change your atmosphere like that, as far as an artist is concerned, every now and then, to just to recreate. I think that's the optimistic way to look at the breakup of the Allman Brothers Band. Why we broke up is a million reasons, you know, just maybe that was underlying the whole thing. I think everybody was ready for a change. You know, I guess especially for Greg and myself, because we were the main writers in the group. Well, I guess the only writers. And we were with the group for the entire 8 years, and so I think we really needed the change that's come about.
I must ask you the inevitable questions about the atmosphere that surrounded the termination of the group. And of everyone concerned, you chose to make the break total and complete.
I had talked with a number of record people, and Clive Davis just was really, truly interested in the band and the music. I would get calls from him at home in Georgia, you know. I thought, well, you know, this is not the third or fourth man in the company calling us. You know, Clive is really interested. And, of course, it is a good company when you get companies like Epic and Columbia and Arista. They're all good companies, you know, Atlantic. You know.
Was this new album a conscious attempt on your part to reach a new audience or to stay connected with the people that had followed you from the earlier days?
I always record with the people in mind that I already know. Mm-hmm. You know, I wasn't really being abstract when it came to my audience. And, yeah, I did it especially for the people that I knew.
How do you mix the balance of old familiar things with the new stuff that you're doing?
It reminds me of a lot of the early days with the Allman Brothers, you know, because...
How so?
I got so bored with just not being under any pressure to come up with a spectacular show, because all we had to do, we got so big at one point that we could just go on stage and make an appearance, and that's, you know, the people that came would go crazy over it, you know. And I used to think, you know, how rewarding it was to get out and really have to hustle and really have to work hard and play in the smaller places, you know, play for 3,000 people. So now we're on the road, we're traveling in a Silver Eagle bus, you know. It's more like we're on the road and we're a rock and roll band again. And in that way, it reminds me a lot of the early days of the Allman Brothers.
This is Pete Fornatale with Dickie Betts, and we'll be back in a moment. This is Pete Fornatale on the Crawdaddy Rock Review. We're talking to Dickie Betts. Dickie, in what other ways is touring with your new group different than touring with the Allman Brothers?
Well, a lot of times we're not headlining, too, now.
How is that, Dickie? Is that an ego blow to suddenly not be headlining anymore?
I think it could be. It could get to be a real problem if you weren't careful. It took me a little while to get used to sort of what we were just talking about, not headlining 20,000 seat halls. Then I got into the beauty of not doing it, you know, just back in smaller places and playing guest appearances on shows with people. And the strange part is guest starring with people that were opening for you, you know, just 6 months ago, you know.
Boy, talk about full.
Let's say Marshall Tucker or something, but it's not hard to get a real nice feel for that sort of thing. You know?
You've lived with the new material now for a while. Are favorites from the first Great Southern album beginning to crop up?
I think Bougainvillea is the overall favorite with all the players.
Bougainvillea is...
It's a real serious piece of music, you know, I mean, solid piece of music.
But the word itself is...
It's a tropical flower.
Ah, I see. Mm-hmm. And now you wrote that,
mm-hmm.
And the inspiration for it was the flower itself.
That's kind of a pretty little story, you know. After all, it is a song about a flower. Actually, you smoke them.
That's wonderful. Let us listen to a bit of Bougainvillea from Dickie Betts and Great Southern.
For my love and me.
debut album by Dickie Betts and Great Southern. That's Bougainvillea. Which of the tunes from those classic days holds up for you and is not, as we said earlier, either boring or overdone and still makes it for you in live performance today?
I don't know. I'm probably the worst person to ask which is the best tune. I think the most serious piece of music I've ever written as far as concept and composition is High Falls.
Ah, which was on your solo album?
No, it was on Win, Lose, or Draw.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And, but I don't know, Elizabeth Reed, you know, is a real solid piece of music that it was the first instrumental that the Allman Brothers ever recorded. It was the, I believe it was the first thing that I'd ever written that we recorded. And we played it every show without fail. And with Great Southern, we've played every show without fail. We have to, because people will throw stuff at us. We don't, you know, we don't play it.
In choosing to use two drummers, and was there a definite sense that you were patterning Great Southern after the experience that you had had with the brothers?
I would say probably so. Well, I really couldn't see doing it any other way.
What got you into music?
I was playing music in the second grade, before school, I guess. I was playing when I was five.
Wow.
So I don't know what got me into it. I just...
Do you remember specific influences, things that turned you on?
That early?
Yeah.
Well, my father.
Oh, really?
You know, because he played, you know.
Who did you listen to on the radio?
My favorite when I was real young was Hank Williams. Of course, then Jerry Lee Lewis, and by the time Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis Presley and all those people came out, I was hot riding around in a car, you know, which really affects my playing today a lot, you know, from listening to Hank Williams and all that health and happiness show they used to have, and the Grand Ole Opry. It has a strong influence on my playing today.
Any definite recording plans yet, Dickie?
The thing right now that's holding us up is trying to decide on who to produce.
Now, you produced the first...
Yeah, I produced just because I couldn't find anybody that I knew well enough to turn that over to. Now, it won't be as hard now to find a producer because he'll have that album to go by.
Let me wrap up with an off-the-wall question.
Yeah.
Are you pleased with the way things are going in the current administration to which... you contributed so much of your talent to help bring about in a very real sense?
Well,
are you a political person?
I'm not a political expert, you know, but I am interested in everything, you know, as much as I can be. I'm real proud of Jimmy Carter myself. I think he's doing a great job. He's made a lot of moves that weren't the best moves for his standing with the people that he has to work with, you know. The draft,
certainly so.
The draft evasion thing with Vietnam and working on making marijuana a misdemeanor. That is really a really heavy thing when you figure like 16, 17, 18-year-old people are getting busted and thrown in jail with really criminal-minded people. And, you know, they come out of jail hardened, you know, calloused.
One last question, Dickie. What do you think the greatest contribution of the Allman Brothers Band to that art of music will turn out to be?
I think that we opened the door for a lot of groups in the South in a little different aspect than most people think. I think when you say this, a lot of people think that, well, nobody from the South, you know, that had bands have ever made it, you know. Well, They were making it, but what most bands from the South were doing was going to L.A., you know, moving their band to
right.
L.A., and they were at, then they became an L.A. band, or coming to New York, you know, and working out of New York. But the Allman Brothers chose to stay in the South and tell, you know, just, yes, we're from the South, we're Southern people, we have a Southern band, and we like it here, you know.
Dickie Betts and Great Southern is certainly a continuation of that tradition, and it was a real pleasure having you here today.
I enjoyed it.
Continued success.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Crawdaddy Rock Review with me, Pete Fornital. The Crawdaddy Rock Review is produced by Cinema Sound Limited in association with the editors of Crawdaddy Magazine and presented by Discwasher. Production techniques and engineering by Martin Brooks. Direction by Len Dugot.